You know, if you speak the truth about Islam, you could be banned from England today?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, and we are going to have a thoroughly eye-opening and exciting broadcast today. Michael Brown, thanks for joining us. Before I tell you what's coming today, here's the number to call, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Some years ago, many years ago, when I lived on Long Island, guy called me and told me he had received a revelation from the Lord and that he was one of the two witnesses in the book of Revelation. But the big news was I was the other witness in the book of Revelation. So I told him, sorry, buddy, neither of us are the two prophesied witnesses in the book of Revelation. Well, right before the broadcast today, I got a note from the director of our ministry here, wanted me to know if I knew a particular gentleman, gave me his name. I said, never heard of him. She said, well, he drove up from Georgia to see me. Really? Never heard of him. Well, as she talked to him a little bit longer, we found out that he is the second coming of Jesus and that he himself is Yah. I guess Yahweh. And what on our address? Well, you see, he gave himself away right there, because if he was really the Lord, he wouldn't need to ask for our address. So, aha, we found him out. Poor guy. There are a lot of demented people out there. Poor guy. But that's what we were dealing with immediately before the broadcast started today. I want you to know, friends, I felt so privileged yesterday to have a broadcast that goes across the country, that speaks to you in cities across America on live radio, so I could bring you a kingdom perspective as best as I could before the Lord and how we should respond to the Supreme Court ruling. So during the show, I spoke for about 5 minutes in particular with 7 points that had been on my heart about our response to the Supreme Court ruling. And earlier in the day, I encouraged everyone to stop and read Psalm 2. Later in the broadcast today, I'm going to come back to Psalm 2 and give you some Messianic Jewish thoughts on Psalm 2. But we recorded that. We put the 5 minutes or so on video. And then I got home last night. We had a board meeting for a missions organization here. Always amazing to hear what our grads are doing around the world. So we had the board meeting. I got home. I was real tired because I hadn't slept much the night before. And just felt compelled to write. I wrote 2 articles. One, a real prophetic call to Christian leaders in America. The other, an article on why same-sex marriage will ultimately fail. So the video, the 2 articles have been getting a lot of response. I felt when I got home, chatted with Nancy a bit, and then I was going to write. And I felt like when I went to sit down at my laptop and start to write, that was my weapon. That was the smoking, burning weapon, because the weapons we fight with are not material, earthly. I'm not talking about when the U.S. military is in military intervention or something like that, or Israel's defending itself. I'm talking about as followers of Jesus, we're not fighting a physical war with physical enemies, and we're not trying to overthrow the government with an earthly revolution. The revolution we speak of is far more radical, a Jesus revolution that overcomes evil with good, that overcomes hatred with love, that overcomes errors with truth. So I really encourage you to read the articles. One is called The Black Robe Regiment, Then and Now, A Fresh Call to Revolution. The other, Why Same-Sex Marriage Will Ultimately Fail. And then the video response to the Supreme Court decisions yesterday. So just go to my website, askdrbrown.org, and click on latest article. You can read the articles, latest video. You can watch the video from yesterday's broadcast. When we come back, I'm going to speak with a man who has been telling the truth about Islam on his website for some years, as a result of which, get this, he has been banned from the UK.
Change the world. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thursday is our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast, and many times we'll look at wider issues regarding the Middle East, sometimes focusing in on Islam in particular, not just in the Middle East, but around the world. And second hour today, you can catch online if you're not able to listen on radio. I'll be interviewing Messianic Jewish worship leader Paul Wilbur. But something happened just in the last few days, so outrageous, I felt it was imperative to bring it to your attention. I wrote an article a few weeks ago on townhall.com, Is Radical Islam Normative Islam? I just heard from one of our grads in the Netherlands that her brother works with a leading Dutch parliamentarian who's been speaking out against Islam. He was given the article. They then made copies to give it to every parliamentarian in the Netherlands to read. These are things that need to be spoken about. My guest, Robert Spencer, jihadwatch.org, has been exposing radical Islam, or perhaps this is just normative Islam, quote, the religion of peace, for years now. And he's been doing it just in a clear-headed way and never calling for violent reprisals against Muslims. And something shocking happened to him recently. Robert, thank you so much for joining us again on The Line of Fire.
Hey, thanks for having me on again.
All right, first, just let our listeners know, if they're not familiar with Jihad Watch, what it is that you've been publishing. You have best-selling books with major respected publishers. Jihad Watch is regularly updated. What's your goal in terms of the information you're getting out?
Well, what I'm trying to do is raise awareness about the nature and the magnitude of the jihad threat. Everybody knows that America was hit hard on September 11th, 2001. And yet, even in the years now since then, there is still no agreement as to who exactly did it, why they did it, and what we need to do about it. And that's what really I'm dedicated to illuminating, to looking at the writings and the statements of jihad terrorists themselves and the teachings of the Quran and of Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, to show what exactly these people are all about, what they want to accomplish, how they intend to go about it. And so I don't see really why any of this would be controversial. I mean, I'm used to the idea now, of course, that it is. But it's just the truth, you know. The Quran says what it says. Muhammad said what he said. Islamic jihadis say what they say. I report on all these things, and this has made me the target of a campaign of smears and defamation that intend to convince people that what I'm doing is hateful and bigoted. When I think the truth cannot be hateful and bigoted. The truth is the truth. If the Quran teaches violence against unbelievers, then it does. And it's not that I made that up to hate Muslims with. It's in there for anybody to read.
All right. Before we get to the controversy that surrounds you right now, a complete outrage, really, let's just put this on the table. Would you be happy, would you be pleased if your writings incited violence against Muslims?
Oh, of course not. I'm not about inciting violence. I'm about opposing violence. I'm about an authoritarian and violent ideology that I am opposing. And I think that, we hear all the time that Muslims abhor jihad terrorism and oppose it and consider that it's a perversion of Islam. And I think that any Muslim who actually believes that jihad terrorism has nothing to do with Islam ought to be standing with us. We are opposing violence committed in the name of Islam, and so any Muslim who opposes it as well ought to see us as an ally and not as an opponent.
All right, and one other question then. What of the charge that you hear constantly that this is fringe extremists? Number one, you're misquoting, misrepresenting the Quran, and number two, you may have a handful of crazy terrorists out there who misuse the Quran to incite violence against others, but that's not authentic Islam in any way.
Well, this is the situation. If you look, the more you look at Islam, the harder it is, I think, to sustain that perspective. For example, the Islamic faith is centered around four primary schools of jurisprudence. That is, Muslims, Sunni Muslims, are members of one or another of the schools of jurisprudence, the Shafi'i, Maliki, Hanafi, and Hanbali. And they are, it's not as if, in other words, that a Muslim reads the Quran and decides for himself, like a sola scriptura argument, that he will believe this and not believe that. They belong to these schools of jurisprudence, which are essentially interpretative traditions that dictate how a Muslim is to understand the Quran and the teachings of Muhammad. Now, all of those schools of jurisprudence teach that it is part of the responsibility of the Muslim community to wage war against unbelievers and to subjugate them under the rule of Islamic law. Here again, this is a matter of demonstrable fact. I have numerous quotes from authorities from all four of those schools of jurisprudence that show this. And so what I would challenge to my adversaries is, could they come up with a sect or school of Islam that actually teaches that Muslims should coexist peacefully with non-Muslims as equals on an indefinite basis without trying to impose Islamic law over them? There is no such school or sect of Islam, and I would challenge anybody to prove otherwise.
All right, and then my last question, if I said my last one was the last, here's my last one before we get to the current controversy. Many historians, religious scholars point back to the, quote, golden age of Islam, and maybe that's around the 13th century and the flowering of intellectualism in Islam and so on. Wasn't that the time that Islam was wiping out Christianity to a large extent in the Middle East and Northern Africa? Wasn't that the time of the golden age of Islam, or am I missing something there?
No, you're quite right. It's paradoxical. It's a strange thing. If you, for example, may recall, not so much in regard to the Middle East and North Africa, but in regard to Spain, that there's a great deal that has been said and written in recent years about the golden age of tolerance that was supposedly in Al-Andalus, Muslim Spain. And there's a book that's probably the foremost exposition of this idea, The Ornament of the World by Maria Rosa Menocal. And in it, she does sketch out this kind of paradise of proto-multiculturalism and harmony between Muslims, Jews, and Christians. But actually, quite early on in the book, she says that Jews and Christians did not enjoy equal rights with Muslims, that they had a humiliating and discriminatory second-class status that was mandated in Islamic law and rooted in the Quran, and that if they got out of line, then there were riots and mass murders. There were 4,000 Jews killed in a pogrom in Granada in 1066 because a Jew was appointed by the Muslim ruler, to be sure, but appointed to be the ruler of the local area, the sort of the mayor of the city. And this was unacceptable because Islamic law does not allow non-Muslims to hold authority over Muslims. And so there was this huge riot, even though the Muslim ruler had been the one who made the appointment, and 4,000 Jews were murdered. So this is the golden age. If the Jews and Christians knew their place and submitted to the overlordship of the Muslims and submitted to the denial of basic rights that Islamic law mandates for the non-Muslims, then sure, everything was great and there was tolerance. But if they wanted equal rights or complained about their plight, then it got to be decidedly more uncomfortable for them.
Mm. Yeah, and of course, you're giving one example to highlight so much of what happened during that time period, what continues to happen. So recently, much of the world is shocked by the brazen brutality of a Muslim slaughtering, or two Muslims slaughtering a British soldier in broad daylight on the streets. And there was clear incitement to these things by comments of some Muslims who are residents in England now. You were heading over to England. We've got about a minute and a half to start the story, then we can finish it on the other side of the break. So what happened to you?
Well, we got banned. I got a letter yesterday from the British Home Office, and it said that it would not
I've got it in my hands, by the way. I'm looking at it, so go ahead, please.
So you see, it would not be conducive to the public good if I went over. And what I think is ironic is that just a couple weeks ago, there was a Muslim leader who was let in who has talked about how jihad means smashing skulls and shedding the blood of infidels and tearing them limb from limb. And he got in, no problem. But we who preach the freedom of speech and equality of rights of all people before the law, that was too much for the British. So it seems you can speak about jihad violence in England, but only if you're for it.
Yeah, concisely said. And this was also applied to Pam Geller as well?
Yes, that's right. We were both banned. We were going together to lay a wreath at a memorial for Lee Rigby, the man who was beheaded by an Islamic jihadist on May 22nd on a street in Woolwich.
Extraordinary. And Robert, as I'm looking at this letter, we'll finish this up when we come back, but they don't want you in England. They don't want anyone that's going to express views that, quote, foment or justify terrorist violence in furtherance of particular beliefs, seek to provoke others to terrorist attacks. I mean, here is a man exposing these things, and by exposing them, he gets now on the list of people trying to foment them by the British government. Jihadwatch.org. Go there and have your eyes open. We'll be right back with Robert Spencer.
Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
The British government Home Office does not want Robert Spencer in their country. One reason is they don't want people who express views that foment other serious criminal activity or seek to provoke others to serious criminal acts. Robert, this is nothing less than outrageous. It's one thing if Saudi Arabia said we don't want Robert Spencer in our country, and I don't really know how much street walking time you'd get to do there anyway. But England, where they just had this atrocity perpetuated against one of their own, where they had their own bombings, their own mini 9/11, you could say, and they were shocked to see these were homegrown British boys that had grown up there. What do you make of this?
I think that the British government is in fear. It's paralyzed by fear that they do not know what to do about these jihadis and Islamic supremacists in their midst. And they are hoping that by silencing any honest discussion about it, that the problem will just go away and blow over. And this is the great difficulty, that they are paving the way, really, for their own subjugation and destruction by avoiding this problem. But I think that they are hoping that by avoiding it, it'll just blow over.
So the Muslims legally, of course, continue to build mosques and have their prayer calls in city after city. Muhammad is now the number one name, boy's name in England. It passed Jack some time back. Church attendance continues to be at all-time low. Mosque attendance continues to surge. And they somehow think it's just going to go away?
Yes. You know, the idea that my talk, my presence really in England and Pamela Geller's as well, would be not conducive to the public good is based on the idea that silence in the face of this problem is preferable to honest discussion of it. It's predicated on the idea that if we just don't antagonize them, then there won't be any antagonism. If we just don't offend the Muslims, then the Muslims won't bother us. It's predicated, in other words, on the idea that the jihad against the West, and against England in particular, is because we're mean to them. And if we stop being mean to them, there won't be any jihad. The idea that there's jihad warfare and subjugation of the infidels preached in the core texts and teachings of the Islamic faith, that just doesn't enter in. That's something that they their politically correct false analyses have already told them isn't true.
You know what's interesting, though, as you describe this, the second-class citizenship, the dhimmitude that they want to subject people to, it's almost as if we say yes in advance.
We
capitulate in advance before we have to. And it's one thing to say, let's be neighbors, and if you have a Muslim neighbor that completely renounces these things, is just a regular person, well, then work together against extremism wherever you find it, whatever religion. It just so happens to be that Islam is in particular conducive to and fertile ground for violent acts in the name of religion. So, Robert, last minute, right now I've been reading reports in Egypt about Sunni Muslims killing Shiite Muslims. We know that's a lot of what's happening in the civil war in Syria. Would you say that Muslims are the victims of Muslim violence, perhaps more than anyone?
Oh, certainly, yes. I mean, see, the problem is that you've got a theology there that teaches that heretics and apostates must be put to death. And so Sunnis disagree with Shiites, they think we got to put the Shiites to death. Shiites disagree with Sunnis, and they think they got to put the Sunnis to death. And so you've got this ongoing 1,400-year war that, of course, just like all these ongoing feuds, it has its hot moments and its cool moments, and now it's heating up quite a bit because Syria has become a battleground, as well as Iraq, between Sunnis and Shiites. And we see this ideology, this belief system playing out in this violence, and that makes it all the more imperative that we discuss this belief system honestly and formulate ways to deal with this so that we can live in peace with one another and that Muslims can live in peace with one another rather than just sweeping it all under the rug.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll tell you, if I were you, Robert, I would frame this letter and keep it as a letter of honor. As tragic and pitiful as it is, it's still the result of you speaking the truth. And it's because you keep putting it out there just in undeniable ways that you're getting this attack. So we are very much appreciative of the work you do. Friends, go to jihadwatch.org. Go there regularly and then check out all of Robert's books and resources that are there. Thanks for the call and thanks for your gracious attitude in the midst of the conflict.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being willing to discuss this. Few have the courage these days.
Oh, well, by all means. All right. Thank you so much. Friends, this is reality. This is reality. Does it mean that every Muslim is a terrorist? No, no, no. Does it mean that every Muslim wants to behead you or that most Muslims want to behead you? No. It means that those who are the most orthodox practitioners of their faith find ample excuse for violent expressions in the name of their religion. All the more do we want to pray for an outpouring of the Spirit in the Muslim world. I personally feel that if there's any group of people after the Jewish people that are kind of marked by God worldwide for end time revival, it's Muslims. So let's really pray. And of course, many, many thousands are coming to the Lord. It is something I hope to do again in my own life to get my Arabic in better shape and to study Islam more diligently so that I can be better prepared for Islamic apologetics as well. Joey, let's play that clip. I want you to hear some beautiful, wonderful music.
The mountains shake before him, the demons run and flee. At the mention of your name, King of Majesty, there is no power in hell or any who can stand before the power and the presence of the great I am. The great I am. The great I am. The great I am. The great I am.
That is the wonderful voice of my dear friend Paul Wilbur, one of the premier anointed Messianic Jewish worship leaders, period, anywhere in the world. We will have Paul on later today, and I want to encourage you to take advantage of this offer. We're offering his new CD, Your Great Name, together with a great one-hour interview we plan to do a little later today on the air. $20 postage paid, but if you can help with an additional gift, that would be wonderful as we help raise funds for our national TV show, Answering Your Toughest Questions, which will start with 32 weeks on Jewish apologetics, and we're starting in less than 2 weeks. Wow. Call right now, 1-800-278-9978. We don't have this on our website, so you have to call in for this. 1-800-278-9978. One more time, 1-800-278-9978. Have you read Psalm 2 yet? Step back and do it. Apropos yesterday, apropos every day. That's where I'm going next. Psalm 2.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Because I'm going to have Paul Wilbur on a half hour from now, some are like, but I don't get the show the second hour. Just go to our website, askdrbrown.org. Whenever you get a chance, later today, you'll be able to listen to the entire show free online. Every show is archived. If you missed any of yesterday's show, I believe we had a lot of important things to say with a lot of important guests concerning the Supreme Court ruling regarding redefining marriage. So I want to take advantage of this next half hour with you. If you have any Jewish related question, because I won't be doing this when I bring Paul on from 3 to 4. If you have any Jewish related question, please give me a call right now, 866-348-7884, 866-34-TRUTH. Yeah, I know, I said 3 to 4, that's Eastern Standard Time, and you're listening in different parts of the country, and someone's listening in with a satellite receiver in a mud hut in a jungle in Timbuktu somewhere, so I apologize if I gave a wrong time frame to you. But I won't have time for your Jewish-related questions in the next hour. So if you have one, by all means, give me a call, 866-348-7884. I was up, as I generally am, very late Tuesday night. I'm generally up very late every night. And when I'm on a real good roll writing or studying or seeking the Lord about things, I normally go to sleep between 3 and 4 in the morning. And then sometimes I get up pretty early. I mean, pretty early for me would be like 8 or 9 or something. Do some things and then go back to sleep late morning just to rest a little bit more, because I don't know about you, but I don't make it on just 4 or 5 hours sleep with any consistency. I need to sleep like everyone else. But yesterday I was just so charged. I got up in the morning. I knew that the Supreme Court decision was going to be forthcoming around 10. I wanted to hear it and then see what I sensed in my own heart as to how I was to respond. Now, I don't always feel the need to. For example, there is major discussion about the immigration bill. I don't feel I have special insight on that. When we'll do a show about that, because I believe it's an important issue, where does justice and righteousness fall on that issue? I'll have to bring special guests on, because I really don't feel I have special insight on that. So many economic issues we face, so many world political issues we face, I just don't feel that I have special insight on them. But then there are areas where I really feel I do have insight, and the Lord really wants me to be a watchman on the wall in that respect, or help strengthen you and encourage you with thoughts for you to digest and process. So yesterday was one of those days. And as I was considering how to respond and considering what I should say on the air and what I should begin to put out through social media, I immediately was drawn to Psalm 2, which I'm going to read for you and explain in terms of the messianic prophetic context of Psalm 2. I felt to go to Psalm 2, and I sent out a note, Facebook, Twitter, that just said, I recommend that you stop what you're doing and read Psalm 2. And started to get people posting it and retweeting it and sharing it left and right. But what's interesting is one of my closest friends and colleagues, a fellow faculty member here at Fire School of Ministry, sent a note to me saying he was up earlier in the day. That was part of his devotional reading for the day. He was reading through Psalm 2 and praying and interceding and giving thanksgiving before he even knew it was coming down that day. And then someone posted on Facebook and said, hey, I was in Psalm 2 earlier. And he said, and I've heard from a bunch of other people who were. So it seems as if this was something that God was saying to us. He is the king. He is the ruler. He is on the throne. Human beings are often trying to cast off the rule and the ways of God. God's saying, I laugh at them when they do, because I have appointed my son as king.
Cleansing flame, send the fire. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us, friends, on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-348-7884. Before I go to the phones with your Jewish-related questions, I want to reflect on Psalm 2 with you for a moment, and I want to give you a principle of interpreting Messianic prophecy. Are you ready? When I came to faith, issues having to do with Jewishness, Jewish objections to Jesus, hardly existed to me. My biggest issue was pride. As a 16-year-old, a strong-headed young person, full of pride, full of self-will, full of rebellion, my biggest issue was pride. To admit that I was wrong, to tell everyone that I was wrong and humble myself, that was my biggest issue. Second, and it was a close second, was my love for and addiction to drugs, especially putting the needle in my arm, and the whole lifestyle I had set before me, wanting to be some rock star drummer and enjoy the life of sin. Being Jewish was an issue in terms of Jews don't believe in Jesus, you know, that common saying, but that was a distant third. No one had to show me Messianic prophecy for me to get saved. No one had to overcome my many Jewish objections. I really didn't have them. I had other objections, other issues. Once I came to faith in Jesus as a Jewish follower of Jesus, Yeshua, once I came to faith, then began to talk to my wonderful Jewish dad. Then I began to talk to the local rabbi. And then I tried to witness to every Jew I could find. And I, you know, someone gave me a track, and here it shows 2 Samuel 7, and I'll be a father to him, and he'll be my son. And I showed the rabbi, look, that's a messianic prophecy that God will have a son. Read the context. It's God telling David. It's God telling David, any of your successors, I'll be a father to them, there'll be a son. It's just the line of David. The king would be like a son to God. Oh, seemed like a messianic prophecy. Whatever I'd show him, no, look at the context. Well, the more I began to study this issue, the clearer it became to me that there were many promises that were given to the line of David, promises that were given to the king who would rule, be it David himself or Solomon or his successor. And those promises were never fulfilled. And that is how God began to build the messianic hope in his people. It was not just an overt description that a Messiah will come one day that would almost be detached from the daily life of the people, as much as there will be a king even greater than David from the Davidic line. And when king after king after king failed, then the many glorious prophetic words that had been spoken over those kings began to be understood as more than just a promise to an earthly king. They began to be understood as messianic in content. Now, the messianic purpose and promise was in the heart of God before the world was created. But the realization of that purpose, the understanding of it in the minds of the people of Israel, that took time to develop. So my understanding of Psalm 2, along with other Old Testament scholars, is that it was originally a coronation psalm, that this psalm would have been recited at the coronation, be it of David or Solomon, but in all likelihood, every subsequent Davidic king. And during the days of David and Solomon, they had a small empire. There were nations that were under them, subjugated to them, and the promise of God was that all nations would be subjugated. So this is a coronation psalm that speaks of the purposes of God. Why did the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. Now, I'm looking at the ESV, and it has anointed in capital A, but it shouldn't. It should just be small a, because this is originally spoken over a Davidic king in that day. Why did the nations rage, the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. So this is the world rebelling against God and his anointed servant, who is the Davidic king, who will one day rule the entire world. Now, it hadn't happened yet, but that's part of the coronation psalm. It's a prophetic word of things to come. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, as for me, I've set my king on Zion, my holy hill. So that's God's answer to the nations as they rage. That's God's answer to the nations as they say that they're going to lift up their heel in rebellion against God. He said, right. I've got my anointed one I've established. And the nations want to fight against God and his anointed one. You say that's obviously Jesus. Ultimately, yes. And there are rabbinic commentaries who say that Psalm 2 is about David and the Messiah, which in a sense is very true. And there are other rabbinic commentaries that say that this is a psalm every time the enemies of Israel rise against Israel. That's truth in that as well. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I've begotten you. Capital S in son, I would have a small s because initially it's spoken of the Davidic king. Ultimately, capital S for the Son of God, Yeshua, yes. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Oh, in a very unique sense, the Son proceeding forth from the Father, it applies to Jesus, Yeshua. But in a lesser sense, it applied to the earthly king who was considered to be a son of God upon his enthronement. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Did that ever happen in the days of David? Not fully. Solomon? Certainly not fully. Any Davidic king after that, not fully. Jesus, Yeshua, every day his rule and reign increases. And one day he will establish his kingdom fully on the earth. Now therefore, O kings, be wise, be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. I wrote a detailed philological article that I delivered at a scholarly conference many years ago. On those words, kiss the Son, I would say pay homage to the Son, or perhaps it could have even originally been pay homage to his Son. I believe that is how it should be interpreted. Initially a warning to submit to the king in Jerusalem, ultimately a warning to submit to the Messianic king. And you see, this psalm would be read at the coronation of each new Davidic king, and each one would fall short. And then after the Babylonian exile, they didn't even have a king anymore. They have a governor. And they're not allowed to have a king by the Persians and others over them. And they don't even have the physical throne of David anymore. You go back and read the psalm, you say, where is that anointed one? Where is this Son of God? Where is this one who will rule and reign? Ah, and you see the people then begin to understand, and the people then begin to look for the great Messianic deliverer. If you want to dig into this more, Volume 3 of my 5-volume series, Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, Volume 3 is where I especially get into that. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Seth in Uniondale on Long Island. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hi. I was just calling about Acts chapter 15, verses 20, the four instructions that were given to the people that were coming into faith. At the mm-hmm. time, there were many people from the nations coming in, and then there was a controversy. The question I was going to ask was the blood, the strangled food, animals, I should say, food sacrifice to idols and sexual immorality. The instruction about the strangled animals, people that have written the Greek word, they said was the word panictos, and they said that makes a reference to the chapter of Leviticus 11, and they said that when scribes were, you know, conveying this information, after it was overwhelmingly Gentile, the faith, that they did not particularly care for this instruction, so they tried to rewrite it in some manuscripts. So I looked at a few different sources to make sure that this person was making the right statement, but it seems like this word strangled animals, it seems, is a reference to the dietary laws that was given in the Torah. So I was wanting to see what your thoughts.
No, it simply goes, yeah, I don't know. Can you mention the author of that article that you're citing online that you found?
Well, it was a book. It was called God-Fearers, Gentiles, and the God of Israel.
By whom?
And Toby, I'm going to mess this last name up. It's J A N I-C-K-I.
Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah, no, in short, this goes back to Genesis 9. You don't have to look at Leviticus 11 at all. It goes back to Genesis 9. And ultimately, there are so-called seven laws of Noah, which Judaism said if you're a Gentile and you simply want to be a God-fearer and you don't want to fully convert to Judaism, these are what you have to take on yourself. So these four all would have been included among those seven laws, but those are ultimately derived from Genesis 9. So as to a scribe trying to change things, I'll have to look into that charge. I don't want to just dismiss it out of hand. But in point of fact, it's pretty simply understood that these were just basic things so that the Gentile, new Gentile believers could have table fellowship with their Jewish brothers and sisters. Thank you, sir, for the call.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
My friends, I want to encourage you to be listening the next hour. If you need to do that on internet or just catch the broadcast later today, by all means do so. I'll be interviewing my dear friend and colleague, Paul Wilbert, one of the world's premier worship leaders, Messianic Jewish worship leaders, and a wonderful friend and brother. We'll be talking about his new CD, Your Great Name. So I know you'll want to catch that. And again, you can do so by going to my website, AskDrBrown.org, and you can just click on Latest Audio later today, and you will be able to listen to the entire broadcast. Also, have you read my article for Christian Leaders Across America, The Black-Robed Regiment, Then and Now, A Fresh Call to Revolution, a response to what happened yesterday at Supreme Court? Read it. Please read it. You'll want to share it. And then another article I wrote on townhall.com, Why Same-Sex Marriage Will Ultimately Fail. Please check that out. You can just click on latest articles on my website to read both of these, all right? I really encourage you to do so. I think you'll find them to be essential, important messages. And then we recorded a video, a segment from my broadcast yesterday where I respond to the Supreme Court's rulings, giving you 7 points, faith-building points as well. And you can just click on latest video to watch that. That's why we have the website, to make tons of free information available to you in the most accessible possible form. Let's go to Matt. Somewhere in Suffolk County on Long Island. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hi, this is Matt. I'm driving. I just wanted to ask a question about the Orthodox Jewish Bible. It's a two-part question. My son actually saw the translation on my Kindle Fire yesterday. We were looking at the Bible app. And I was wondering, first, why some words are in English and some words are in Hebrew? And the second question, which is actually my son asked, and I didn't know the answer to it, was he said, well, there's no New Testament, right, because it's the Orthodox Jewish Bible, and I was in the New Testament, so I didn't know how to answer it, and I was hoping that you could offer insight.
Yeah, so your son was asking as to what was missing?
Okay, well, we were in John, and I just happened to select the Orthodox Jewish Bible translation.
Right,
and
right.
My son was confused as to why the New Testament would be in there if it was the Orthodox Jewish Bible.
Okay, got it. Just wanted to be clear I understood that. All right, yeah, I know the folks who are involved with the Orthodox Jewish Bible, and it is an absolutely unique project. It is a one of its kind that does serve a particular need. When you talk to, have you ever heard, to use another language analogy, have you ever heard someone from the Philippines speak and they'll be speaking English with an accent and then they'll tie in their Filipino dialect and go back and forth? I don't know if you ever heard that.
But okay, yeah, I can imagine.
Right. So when you talk to an ultra-Orthodox Jew, they have a language that some have called yeshivish, which will use English words and in ways that we might not be used to using them because they're just specific, ways of yeshiva study and communication. But then they have a lot of Yiddish words and and Hebrew words that are weaved in. So unless you understand it, you're going to miss a lot of it. Well, this was a translation of the Bible, and the particular new thing was the New Testament, to say, okay, let's try to convey this in a way that a very traditional Jew would understand. So this Jewish person would be able to read it. And, you know, in fact, I wasn't anticipating a question on Orthodox Jewish Bible. I've got it across the room from me. Maybe I can grab it, just have Matt bring it over to me. But it is really, really unique. And it's made, here we go. No, not that one. Not that one, Matt. That was actually an Orthodox Jewish translation of the five books of Moses. This is of the New Testament. I've only got about 9 million books from him to choose from. No, that's my doctoral dissertation, man. Come on. What's that got to? Don't worry. No. Don't worry about it. Just, I got too many books to pick from. But anyway, if you're reading it, you're like, what in the world? It's going from English, and then this is straight Hebrew, and then some of it's explained, and then it's got a lot of stuff about the Rebbe. It's Rebbe. Who's the Rebbe? Isn't that an Orthodox Jewish leader in Brooklyn or something? And what it is it was a way. There we go. Yeah, I'll just open up. Here I am. John, we're somewhere in John. They were saying, therefore, to him, who are you? Rebbe Melech HaMashiach said to them, why should I even speak to you at all? I've heard from one having sent me is Naaman, and I, what I heard from him, these things I speak in the Olam Hazeh. I think, what in the world? So Rebbe, that would be another way of saying master, rabbi, but master with respect. Melech HaMashiach, that's King Messiah. And then he says, the one who sent me is Naaman, which is faithful. And he says, I have much to speak regarding you, much about you worthy of harsha'ah, condemnation. And I'm speaking about things in the Olam Hazeh, which is this world. So you think, what? I don't get this. But it's written by a former ultra-Orthodox Jew and another believer who's worked doing outreach to ultra-Orthodox Jews for many, many years to try to make the New Testament text accessible to them. So here, let me just take one more second. So that's what it's for, as they come to faith, that they'll have something if they want to read in English. So here we've got, Bereshis was the Dvar Hashem, and the Dvar Hashem was Agav Hashem. This is John 1:1. And the Dvar Hashem was nothing less by nature than Elohim. So Bereshis, that's in the beginning, but with an Ashkenazi pronunciation, was the Dvar Hashem, the word of the Lord. And the Dvar Hashem was Agav, along with Hashem, the Lord. And Dvar Hashem was nothing less by nature than Elohim, God. So if you don't know the terminology in the Hebrew or the Yiddish that's being used, you'll be totally lost. But if you do understand it, it is a great tool. Hey, Matt, I got to run out of time. Friends, get hold of the wonderful Paul Wilbur CD, his new CD, Your Great Name. We're offering it together with the one-hour interview I'm about to do with Paul. $20 postage paid, but if you can help with an additional gift, it would really help us as we get ready to launch our national TV show, and that'll start with 32 weeks of answering Jewish objections to Jesus, national TV history, with your help, by God's grace. Call to stand with us and to get your own CD, 1-800-278-9978, 1-800-278-9978. One more time, 1-800-278-9978. This is by phone only. We don't have this online, 1-800-278-9978. My bottom line today, as we see increasing upheaval and shaking in our society, let us put our focus all the more on the one and only true God. You do not want to miss this interview on The Line of Fire. I will be joined by Paul Wilbur, one of the world's premier Messianic Jewish worship artists.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, I am really looking forward to this next hour on the air with my dear friend and colleague, Paul Wilbur. We've had the joy of ministering together many different parts of America and even overseas some. And he's a dear friend. His wife, Luann, his whole family are friends, dear friends of Nancy's and mine, if that's the proper grammar. And many, many a time I've been deeply ministered to in my own spirit, lifted, encouraged, strengthened, blessed just by putting on some of his praise and worship music. So we're going to be hearing through the broadcast today, through this interview, we're going to be hearing some excerpts from clips from Paul's latest project, Your Great Name. And I've got a bunch of questions I want to ask Paul. Paul Wilbur, are you there?
I am here, Dr. Brown.
Great to hear from you. How you doing, man?
Wonderful. Great to talk to you.
So glad to hear that. Paul, I got a bunch of questions I want to ask you as the show goes on, because you've seen some pretty remarkable, amazing things over the years in Africa and Latin America and other places. But how many countries have you ministered in now?
It's over 60. I don't know exactly 60 how many, but it's over 60.
It's over 60. And you ever ministered in any Muslim countries?
Yes, as a matter of fact. I've had a Muslim bodyguard in Dubai. We've been in Dubai a couple of times. We've been in Kuwait. And remarkable results, absolutely remarkable results. I've seen Muslim attitudes turn from hostile to curious about Jesus in the midst of a few minutes. It's really an amazing time.
And have you ever ministered in stadiums that were filled in Latin America?
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
And we'll get to details on all these. I'm just whetting people's appetite.
Yeah, we've been recently we were in Paris, France, which was thought to be one of the most anti-Semitic, most hardened to the gospel nations, incredible results. We were recently in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, where I saw guys in black kippahs that prayed to receive the Lord right there in a coffee house. A couple of weeks ago, we were in Holland with the Dutch Reformed that you think most people would have their arms crossed across their chest and scowling. I'm telling you, Mike, these are the days of Elijah for sure.
Wow. And Paul, you're raised in a home by a Jewish dad. You have considered yourself a Jewish man, and that's in your blood, your wife's blood now, the blood of your kids. Was there ever resistance to you as a Jewish follower of Jesus, Yeshua? Did you go through family hostility in the early days of your faith?
Actually, I did somewhat, but it was quite easily overcome when, you know, when I became a believer back in 1977. My dad was very concerned about me. He wanted me to see a counselor, not necessarily a rabbi, but a counselor who could help me with, I was involved in a cult, and this was really bad stuff for me. Why? Because I was happy all the time. That was a problem. I read my Bible all the time. That was a problem. I wanted to pray all the time. That was a problem. So he wanted me to see some counselors, but he wound up...
You're too happy. When the happiness stayed, his tune changed. All right, we're going to get back to Italy and operatic training.
Give us strength to always do what's right.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Now arise, O Lord, to your resting place with all your power and might, as we stand here clothed with your righteousness.
I know you're saying, Mike, I don't want to hear your voice. I want to hear that voice. I want to hear Paul Wilbur singing. Well, you can get the CD, Your Great Name. We'll tell you how, together with the interview with Paul. You'll be able to get that later in the broadcast. Our grandson, Andrew, one of our two grandsons, is a great fan of Paul, dances around the house to the messianic music of Paul Wilbur. 9 years old now, a few years ago, Paul was ministering, I think, in Ecuador, and he took my phone call to talk to Andrew. Hey, Paul, when we hear your voice, it doesn't sound just like the typical worship leader, singer out there. You're actually operatically trained in Italy. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I went to undergrad school, and I studied there in Cleveland at a pretty well-known music school among musicians called Baldwin Wallace College. And it was there, Mike, that I joined the Temple downtown Cleveland, Abba Hillel Silver's Temple. He's generally accepted as one of the machers of modern-day Reform Judaism. I attended the temple there, sang in the choir. My voice teacher at school was the cantor, and as a result of those years there at the temple and voice training, I wanted to be a cantor and an opera singer like Richard Tucker or Robert Merrill, a couple of very famous Jewish operatic singers who maintained their connection to the synagogue, and they would sing at the Metropolitan Opera, and they would sing at some of the large temples or synagogues around the world. And that was really the model for my life when I went to Italy, studied privately, came back, went to graduate school at Indiana University as a voice major with that very goal in mind, which got interrupted for a life's purpose in March of 1977 when a Baptist from West Texas introduced me to my Messiah.
Paul, how difficult was it for you to believe that Jesus Yeshua was really for us, and what kind of life change did it bring about?
Well, I think, as you might attest as well, that there were stepping stones through my life where I was confronted with the person of Yeshua and the truth of the gospel. And I could take the rest of the 45 minutes, but there were times in my life when I would, different circumstances where someone would put a Bible in my hand or someone would testify to me about Jesus and his life and that I needed to put my trust in him. And although they may have felt at the time, over the years, it felt on deaf ears, that was the evidence was beginning to pile up. Until March 26th of 1977. At that point, Mike, I had already purchased a Bible. I think at that point I'd been confronted so often and really supernaturally by the presence and the power of God in ways that I knew was God. I couldn't say this was Yeshua, but I knew it was the God of the Bible who was confronting me to have a relationship with him. And in March I was of 77, I was on a fishing trip with a Baptist guy who's really on a mission to minister to me personally. Mm-hmm. And I was confronted with the absolute undeniable presence of God as I walked along a river just by myself very early in the morning. I knew he was there. I didn't know what to pray. I didn't know what to say. I simply said, God, I put my trust in you. I give you my life. That was my salvation prayer. I learned in the weeks and months following that who Yeshua is, and put my trust in him. I began to understand depth of the message that I didn't before, of the blood necessary for atonement, and I put my trust in Yeshua as my Passover lamb who took away the sin of the world. And so it was a process for me. And but if they were each of these encounters with the God of Israel, each of them, I knew it was him. And then I learned as a result of handing over my life to him that Jesus really is our promised Messiah. And I've prayed many times in that first year to make sure that I got it right. Because but overnight, really, to answer your other question, overnight, something supernaturally changed. My mouth changed. The way I thought changed. My desires and hopes changed. I exchanged all of my reading material for a Bible, a new covenant NIV that I stuck in my back pocket and began to memorize verses and then chapters, because I found that the Word of God was what was transforming me on the inside and making my desires new, changing the way I thought. And it was, Mike, it was so dramatic that in the first couple of weeks after praying that simple prayer of God, here's my life, I walked downtown Bloomington, Indiana to the State House to legally change my name, because I would look in the mirror and I didn't know who it was looking back. I'd look in the mirror and I'd say, who are you? Who are you? The change was so dramatic.
That's amazing.
And it's been 37 years now.
That's what we call the new birth, huh?
Yeah, amazing.
And really, just out of curiosity, you know, we know some people have changed their names. Chad Johnson became Chad Ochocinco, and the boxer Marvelous Marvin Hagler legally became Marvelous Marvin Hagler. What were you thinking of changing your name to? Well, Paul Newman instead of Paul Wilbur? Or?
No, I actually saw my name, which I believed was my name in the scriptures. Isaiah said that one will take the name Israel and change his name to Jacob. And my grandmother's maiden name was Jacobson, so I was going to change my name legally to Israel Jacobson.
Really? But you know, yeah, what's so fascinating about that is you didn't think of changing your name to a Reverend Christian. That the transformation that you experienced through a Baptist friend sharing the gospel with you, and you're reading a Christian Bible allegedly in this foreign document, causes such a change that you want to call yourself Israel Jacobson. That's remarkable, isn't it?
Well, it was an awakening to, you know, I had known all my life that I was a Jewish guy, but it never really meant anything to me in particular. But once I was born again, all of a sudden, it was like an inheritance. It was like a prodigal that left the pigsty and came home to the house of my real father. I would read books. I would weep over passages of Jeremiah and Isaiah, and I would see I wanted to be who God created me to be. And so, yes, when I got born again, my own Jewishness became very important to me because it's a part of my identity. God made me for a purpose to be as I am, and I wanted to discover the fullness of that purpose.
Yeah, Paul, we come back. I want to talk about the power of worship and praise and why it is God uses these things so supernaturally. And then here's some of the amazing, truly amazing stories of things that have happened around the world. And by the way, that synagogue Paul used to go to in Cleveland as a boy ended up closing down. Years later, we used it for a Messianic Jewish outreach. Paul, with his group Israel's Hope, ministered in song. I preached. A bunch of ultra-Orthodox Jews came from the community to see what was happening and to challenge us and to challenge me after I preached. And as they were doing worship on the inside, I ended up on the street with these men as they were crying out to heaven to send the Mashiach, to send the Messiah. I'm saying, God, open their eyes. I'm right in the midst of, open their eyes. The Mashiach's coming. They're saying, the real Mashiach. I said, yes, the real Mashiach. Right in front of that same synagogue. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, do you recognize this voice? Do you recognize the tune? Let's listen.
The mountains shake before him, the demons run and flee. At the mention of your name, King of Majesty.
Over. Some of the greatest times I've had in my life, honestly, in ministry, have been ministering together with Paul. His website, WilburMinistries.com. That's B-U-R, WilburMinistries.com. Hey, Paul, before we talk about the importance of worship and what God does through it and what can happen through music that perhaps can't happen in other ways, do you mind if we take a call just from... You got a lot of admirers out there. Do you mind if we just take one call with a question for you?
Yeah, sure, that's fine.
All right, let's go to Jaime. Jaime in Brooklyn. Hey, Jaime, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Dr. Brown, can you hear me?
Yeah, loud and clear. You're on the air.
Oh, I am. My heart's like pounding outside of my chest to think that I can talk to you and Mr. Wilbur at the same time. Thank you so much for taking the call.
Go ahead, please.
Okay, Mr. Wilbur, I just got to tell you, I've heard lots of Jewish singers like Simon and Garfunkel and Barry Manilow, even Sammy Davis Jr., but you are by far my favorite, and it's just an honor to talk to you today.
Well, thank you, Jaime. Where are you in? You're in Brooklyn, New York.
Brooklyn, New York, Mill Basin. Yeah, but I just got one little bit out of there question for you from the Hebrew scriptures that I just wanted to ask, and if you could just take a minute, because I'm really struggling with this out of Leviticus 19. It says, you shall not make any cuts in your body, nor make any tattoo marks on yourself. And as a believer in Yeshua HaMashiach, I'm just wondering, as a worshiper, how you feel about tattoos. And if you don't mind just answering that, it would really make my day. And I'll just hang up and listen. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Brown, thank you for taking the call.
You got it. Okay, Paul, tattoos.
Wow. You know, they are very popular today. A lot of folks are putting the ink on. I'm a motorcycle fan. I hang out with a lot of folks that get them, and you know, it's interesting. We're talking about an issue that some would take very strongly as a part of law that we would need to consider as Torah and a part of our life for today. I minister with folks that are, as we say, tatted up, all from head to toe. Does it keep them out of heaven? I would say no, because heaven is a heart issue. It's one of those areas, you know, of law. It's interesting because Mike, you edited a book for me that we've been finishing up that deals with the different kinds of law, moral law and religious law and temple law and the degrees of adherence for us as believers. I'm not one to go running to a tattoo parlor and get my favorite guitar tatted on my shoulder. But
tell you what, let me make a suggestion to you as you are so gently walking through this answer and not wanting to offend or step on toes and recognize liberty but honor Torah. I would suggest that when you get home in a settled place, that you see if you can find any preached messages by a fellow named Scott Volk, who I think you know, and then see if you could run a careful voice analysis for intonation and things like that on those messages to see if it sounds anything like Jaime from Brooklyn, all right?
He got me. He got me.
He got you.
He got me. Wow.
I just didn't realize, though, that you were going to take as much time to try to carefully answer his tattoo question.
Well,
Scott.
I thought he might be a serious guy, but now I'm tracking.
Right. So you owe him one. You definitely owe him one. But I have to say, Paul, that was with my permission. He requested that he be allowed to call in with a question. So anyway, what you just learned is that Paul Wilbur loves the word, but he is a very gentle, pastoral, caring kind of man. actually, Scott is right down the hall from me, so he's not quite in Brooklyn at the moment, one of our dear colleagues here. But that's another piece of Jewish humor, I guess. You didn't even wonder when he said that you were better than Sammy Davis Jr., huh?
Well, you know, I started... But I understand that on a program like yours, Dr. Brown, that there are all different kinds of listeners from all different kinds of backgrounds, and we sure want to be, you know, as gentle as a lamb, but now I know that I'm going to grow a few teeth for that last call.
Yeah. Now, let me just say this, and we will dive in and have a super edifying, enjoyable next half hour. We got a call right before the show. Director of our ministry came in and said, you know so-and-so? He's driven here from Georgia. And he said he knows you. I said, never heard the name. And he was insistent. And then she said, oh, something's funny with this guy. And then she came back on and said, he keeps asking for the address. She sent me an email with a smile. He keeps asking for the address. He is the second coming of Jesus. He is actually Yah. And I said to her, here's how you know he's not. Because he's asking for our address. If he was really God, he wouldn't be asking for the address. But are there people who think that Paul Wilbur is a better Jewish singer than even Sammy Davis Jr.? Yes, there are. Okay, friends, Paul's latest project, just another phenomenal CD, Your Great Name. You can get it together with this interview, including Jaime's call. We will leave that on, which makes it a living classic. Just $20 postage paid for the CD interview and the wonderful Messianic Jewish Worship Project, Paul's first in some time. Call 1-800-278-9978, just $20 postage paid. But if you can help with an additional gift, especially as we launch our national TV show, starting with 32 weeks on answering Jewish objections to Jesus, that would be terrific. 1-800-278-9978. You will be blessed for many years to come. Worshiping along with Paul and his team. 1-800-278-9978. We come back straight to the power of worship and music to change lives with Paul Wilbur.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown.
your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to the Line of Fire broadcast with my dear friend, Paul Wilbur, one of the most called anointed worship leaders I know in the world and a standout in Messianic Jewish worship. He's ministered to packed stadiums in Latin America. He's ministered to royalty in Africa. He's ministered in the Muslim world with Muslim bodyguards getting touched as he ministers. And I'm just thrilled to have him on the broadcast with me. Paul, thanks for joining us on the Line of Fire.
Oh, yeah, Mike, it's always a pleasure, and it's a real privilege for me. Thanks.
All right. Paul, I could get up and preach for an hour and get a certain result, but you could get up literally with a guitar, your guitar in hand, and begin to sing, and within seconds, the whole atmosphere in the place has changed dramatically. I know God's anointing is on you, but there's also something about music, worship, putting truth to music, something about it. What's some of the power of it? What have you discovered in more than 35 years now?
Well, the standard in Psalm 22, verse 3, which is, of course, one of the foundational scriptures of worship, is that God does indeed inhabit the praises of his people. And it can seem so cliche even to quote that verse because it's so often quoted, but it is absolutely the truth. And it's become my purpose in life to create the same atmosphere in earth that is familiar to him in heaven. It's we have the privilege of being the people who take captive the atmosphere through the power of praise and create the same kind of atmosphere that surrounds the throne. And if that sounds too ethereal or too heavy, it's what provoked me to the kingdom in the first place. I go back to a junior high auditorium in Bloomington, Indiana, where a young girl who was my accompanist actually in graduate school invited me to go to church with her. And I was interested in her romantically. And so I said, sure, you know, I'll go to church. I'll go to the ice cream shop. I don't care. Where do you want to go? But the thing that shocked me was a guy got up with his guitar in the middle of the service and just began to sing this song that he'd written. And the atmosphere in the place changed. And it changed so dramatically, Mike, that I felt stuck to my chair, and I said, that's what I'm after. That's what I want to do. That's what I'm made to do, to create the atmosphere that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob finds familiar to him, this is the air that he breathes, because the throne is surrounded 24/7, if you will, with praise and worship. And it's that presence that is the change in the atmosphere. It's not the music. It's the invitation that he accepts. He accepts the invitation of our praise, and he physically comes by the mystery of the Holy Spirit, and his presence is what changes the atmosphere and ultimately speaks into hearts and heals bodies and brings deliverance. And it's an amazing transformation, and we can see it in a football stadium or a tennis stadium in Dubai or someone's living room, like we used to experience ourselves back in Maryland together.
But what a great, clear explanation, though, as God himself comes into this atmosphere where he feels at home in the midst of worship, and he begins to move and touch lives. If we could cultivate that more in our services, think what would happen when we gather together.
Oh God of burning, cleansing flame, send the fire. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
My guest, not singing now, you can get this CD, Your Great Name. We'll tell you how in a little while. Paul Wilbur, his website, Wilbur Ministries, WILBURMinistries.com. Paul, thanks again for joining us on the air today. You knew that some of your material had gotten out in Spanish-speaking countries, but you were stunned when you first went to Latin America and found out about the level of anticipation and the crowds. Tell us what happened and what you attribute that to.
Well, there's I remember I remember very well the first time I was invited to sing in Latin America. It was actually South America in the country of Colombia with Pastor Benny Hinn, who was doing one of his large crusades there. And so he said, would you come and sing Spanish? And I said, well, gosh, I've never sung Spanish before, but I speak Italian. I can sing in German. I'm sure I can sing in Spanish. So I had a couple of my songs translated into Spanish. I worked at them pretty hard, so I had them down. This was back in the late 90s, so the album Shalom Jerusalem was very well known back then, but I didn't know how well it was known in Latin America. So I stood up on the platform. There's about 50,000 people there. I was a little nervous singing in Spanish for the first time in front of 50,000 people who spoke Spanish, even two-year-olds better than I did. So the music started, but the response from the people was so, they exploded. They just exploded. They jumped and danced. And when I began to sing the music in Spanish, they sang in English because they'd only heard it in English. It hadn't been done in Spanish yet. And Pastor Benny was just flabbergasted with the response. So when the song was over, he calls me back and he says, "Brother Paul, one more time." And I say, he wound up having me sing this one song four times in a row because the response from the people was just so overwhelming. And what it did was it put a passion in my heart to lead worship amongst Hispanic people, because I found a love for God in these people, a passion in their worship that I didn't find in most places in the Western world, and got a real love for Spanish. So now we have more CDs in Spanish than English. We record in five languages, and now even on our Facebook, we're doing posts. More than half of our posts are in Spanish. But why is it? That was a question that I began to pursue and found that, gosh, you know, with the Inquisition of Spain in the late 1400s and a lot of many of our Jewish people were thrown out of Spain, where did they come? They came to the Dominican Republic. They came to Cuba, where we're going for the second time this year, by the way, to do the second government-approved Christian, if you will, Christian music concert in Havana, Cuba, again this December. We did the first one last December with Fidel's approval. Just amazing story.
That is amazing. And what about when you went back, once the material had gotten out, and, mm-hmm. and you actually had people waiting in a stadium for your ministry?
Oh, it just blew me away. We would go to do a concert in Guatemala City. This was the first time that I remember it like this. A 7 p.m. concert. 7 p.m. we went to the stadium at 11 a.m. just to see what the stadium was like. And literally, Mike, the line for people to get in wrapped around the football stadium, anticipating to get in for a 7 p.m. Worship concert. And I've fallen in love with Latin America ever since. Have a Spanish teacher. We never do a project without doing it in Spanish as well.
Amazing. And that was part of God beginning to open up the door to these different nations. And you found this extraordinary connection, obviously the presence of God that comes in this unique way. I remember when we were part of the same leadership team in Maryland, that sometimes before we'd start the meeting, you'd take out your guitar. Dan, who was leading our team, would say, Paul, why don't you, you know, lead us? And that was it. That was the end of the meeting. You'd start to play. We'd start to worship. And we never had the meeting, which, of course, was no loss. neither of us were much into the administrative meetings. But anyway, as God opened doors in the Muslim world, obviously they're into, to put it broadly, Abraham, Isaac, and Ishmael, and you're into Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you know, a little different understanding of world history and religious history. What did they tell you to do as far as what you could and couldn't do, and what did you end up doing?
Well, the first time we went to Dubai, they gave me a list of words that I was not to sing or speak from the platform, like Jerusalem, Zion, Israel, Isaac, you know, anything that had to do with a biblical understanding of our faith and a love, of course, for Israel and our Jewish people. So I wanted to be, you know, a man under authority. I went through all of the songs, and I began to rewrite some of the lyrics. So, Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and all the world, and I foolishly went through and changed some of the lyrics to many of the songs. By the time I got to the platform in Dubai, Mike, the anointing, the presence of God was so strong. I didn't change one word. I kept the original lyrics. We declared the gospel. The place was packed, 7,000 people. There was supposed to be an imam there listening to all the words to make sure that we followed the rules. Some reason, he never showed up. There was supposed to be a government official there to make sure that we followed all the rules. He never showed up. My Muslim bodyguard, when we were going to the concert, offered to take the whole band to the best clubs after the concert. He said, I know where all the pretty girls are, and I'll take you to the best clubs in Dubai. After the concert, he stood on the sidewalk with us for over an hour, wanting to know about our faith in Jesus of Nazareth. The presence of God, the glory of God. We've seen people step out of wheelchairs. We have a volunteer here at our office who was in a wheelchair 25 years, came to one of the worship concerts in North Carolina, right there where you are, and in the middle of one of the songs, she forgot that she couldn't stand up and stood up to worship the Lord, and she's not been back in the wheelchair since. We've seen spines that were curved straighten up. We've seen tumors disappear. The Lord is so good. It's who he is. In fact, really, the vision for this new project, Your Great Name, the Lord spoke to me very clearly about 2 years ago. He said, if you have a need, N-E-E-D, if you have a need, I have a name. Call on the name of the Lord. And that's where the vision for. So we declare his names throughout this whole project. He's the great I am. He's El Shaddai. He is Adonai Rofecha. He's the Lord who heals us. He's Yeshua. He is our salvation.
and we declare many of his covenant names throughout this new project.
And God comes and works. Friends, I'm an eyewitness, having been in meetings with Paul and just seeing the Lord move dramatically and mightily, and that's because he's pointing people to Jesus, Yeshua, to the glory of the Father. All right, we've got more to come with Paul Wilbur. Order your copy of Your Great Name, the CD, together with the CD of this wonderful interview with Paul. $20 postage paid, but if you can help with more for our Jewish outreach, that would be wonderful. 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. One more time, 1-800-278-9978. We'll hear some more music from the CD right when we come back as well.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Glory come down. Glory come down. Come down.
Well, Just hearing those words sung, immediately something happens to me. I don't know about you. Let's just listen to a little bit more from Paul Wilbur's new CD, Your Great Name. Yes, this is powerful stuff. Paul, you've had so many amazing experiences around the world. You know it's the hand of God. You're the same person you've always been because you know it's His grace. It doesn't matter what prominence you have, who you meet with. But just to glorify the Lord, maybe you could tell us a story of a door that opened supernaturally in Africa. And what's come out of that? And again, that's you do preach and teach, but primarily the doors have opened through the songs that you've sung for the Lord. Tell me a highlight from Africa.
Hmm. Well, Africa, wow. We've ministered in Zambia, South Africa, Nigeria, Ghana. Probably the most significant door was Zambia. Mm-hmm. A bishop came to, he flew in to the United States through Jacksonville. He came off the plane. He had earbuds in his ear, and the pastor that picked him up said, "What are you listening to?" And the bishop from Nigeria, Zambia, said, "I'm listening to Paul Wilbur." Mm-hmm. And the pastor said, "Hey, Paul lives in Jacksonville. Would you like to meet him?" So they called the office. I said, "Sure, let's have some coffee." We sat down, and this man from Africa, Zambia, said to me, "You must come to my country." And I don't know what came over me, but I looked at him and I said, "I'll come to Zambia when your president invites me." It would take another hour to explain why I said that, but because I learned something about authority. Mm-hmm. As you go from nation to nation, the watchman, the gatekeeper, and it's made a tremendous difference as we travel. But he looked back at me, he said, "That is no problem. I am his pastor." And so 2 weeks later, a personal invitation from the president of Zambia, Mr. Mwanawasa, came to the office. We put together a team. It was an amazing group of people. Steve Summerall joined us from Indiana, and Pastor Bill Winston flew his own plane over. Gateway Church joined us from Dallas. The Lord put together a coalition of some of the finest, and
There was a pastors' conference we had for 3 days. They came from 10 nations in Africa, 3,000 pastors. A medical clinic that ministered to about 7,500 people. I was just looking at some of the pictures yesterday, actually, some of the lives that were saved in that medical clinic. Miraculous healings every day as the pastors, the doctors, would pray for people who would come to the clinic, folks that couldn't obviously afford any help. We fed 1.3 million people with the meals that were brought in on ships that was provided, distributed 50,000 Bibles. The vice president of the nation received us into his office to just say welcome. It was a formality. I reached out my hand to shake hands with him, Mike, and all of a sudden I just began to speak in tongues. It had never happened before. I didn't think about it. It wasn't something I planned. In fact, as it was happening, my mind is saying to me, "What are you doing, you idiot?" And as I stood there shaking hands with this man, began to speak to him in tongues, he prayed to receive Yeshua as his Lord, got on his knees. He said to me, "Paul, I need this in my life." It was one miracle after another. Thousands and thousands gave their lives to the Lord in the stadium. It would take... it would take a week to tell you all the stuff.
And that's one trip, one country. Mm-hmm. And Paul, I've been with you many times, but I only know a few of the stories. And then, of course, I know the household stories and the pets and the dogs and the birds and the things like that. But those, you know, that's for another show. We can just kind of, maybe we're both like 98. We'll reminisce about those things, and no one will know if we're getting them right or wrong at that point. But you know, we had some amazing meetings together in Germany. I think that's the last country we were in together outside of being in the States. But yeah. I'm thrilled to be connected with you. I miss ministering together with you. We just need to find an excuse. We had a good stretch of a few years doing a lot of meetings together, so we've got to find an excuse to do it. Maybe Jaime from Brooklyn can set something up for both of us. And
it'd be wonderful.
Yeah. But, Paul, we will stay connected. I want a whole bunch of folks to get hold of your CD. Friends, go to Wilbur Ministries, W-I-L-B-U-R, WilburMinistries.com, and Paul Wilbur Ministries on Facebook. They're very, very active, posting things there all the time. And I believe, Paul, we're out of time now, but I'm expecting amazing things in the salvation of our Jewish people in the coming days.
Yeah, these are the days of Elijah. We have been brought to the kingdom for just such a time as this. Join us on Facebook. And we also have an amazing ministry, Mike, called Face to Zion, that is uniting believers around the world, lovers of Zion, facetozion.com. You can actually have your image on a glass panel in the Galilee. We're already over 50,000 from around the world. We're looking for millions to raise their voice and stand with us for the salvation of Israel in these days. An amazing ministry, and that's on our website as well.
Terrific. Well, Paul, thanks for joining us. Give my love to your whole family, please.
I will do it as long as you do the same for me.
Deal. All right, friends, call right now, 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978. Get a copy of Paul's CD, Your Great Name, together with the interview we just did. $20 postage paid. If you can help with an additional gift, please do. 1-800-278-9978. One more time, 1-800-278-9978. My bottom line today, let us learn from the words of Paul Wilbur that when we enter into praise and worship, it creates an environment in which God feels at home, and he comes and manifests his glory.